From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the secretive militant Islamic groups of Central Asia, which like Al-Qaeda, are calling for jihad. We talk with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, author of the new book, Jihad. He says that Central Asia is likely to become the next global battleground. This is the area that comprises the republics of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist whose previous book, Taliban, became a number one bestseller after September 11th. Militant Islam in Central Asia, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said today that the United States faces potential attacks from terrorists that could be, in his words, vastly more deadly than September 11th. Rumsfeld made the warning in a speech promoting increased defense spending. He said the danger could be magnified if terrorists are able to obtain nuclear weapons from so-called outlaw nations. President Bush is back in Washington after a three-day trip to southern states to promote the themes outlined in his State of the Union address. His message combines praise of volunteer action with strongly worded warnings against nations that support terrorism. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The people who are coming out to see the president are very enthusiastic. Interestingly enough, each of these events he's done in Florida and North Carolina and Atlanta over the last 2 days have been to promote some aspect of volunteerism, the Senior Corps, the Teach for America program, or some other such program. But at each stop, the president gives an update on the war, and he has had these very, very strong words for countries that would harbor and help terrorists while also trying to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, and his comments have been very enthusiastically received.
NPR's Don Gagne. The apparent kidnappers of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl say they've extended a deadline for killing him. Yesterday, Western news organizations received an email claiming to come from the kidnappers and saying they would kill him in 24 hours if their demands were not met. A second email today extended that deadline for a day. The kidnappers want the return of Pakistani prisoners who were captured with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that the administration is working for Pearl's release, but he said the U.S. won't meet the demand to return the prisoners. The Secretary of Health and Human Services is proposing that a fetus be counted as an unborn child eligible for federal and state health care dollars. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
By counting developing fetuses as unborn children, they could be added to a government health program called CHIP. CHIP provides health care to children in lower-income families. States can already cover pregnant women and their fetuses through the CHIP program, but they first must apply to the federal government for permission. Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson says he plans on issuing a regulation that will eliminate the requirement for states to first get permission. He says the move will make sure more pregnant women get prenatal care. But abortion rights supporters say the move has more to do with giving legal standing to the fetus and making abortions illegal. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 157 points to close at 9,920. The Nasdaq gained 20 to close at 1,931. This is NPR News. Space scientists say that if any pieces from a falling satellite were not burned up in the Earth's atmosphere, they probably fell to the ground somewhere in Egypt. NASA said its 7,000-pound satellite, Extreme Ultraviolet Explorer, broke up as it entered the Earth's atmosphere last night. So far, Egyptian officials say there have been no reports of debris falling from the sky. Philippine troops have recovered the body of Brian Smith, an American man who was killed by unidentified gunmen while trekking on Mount Pinatubo near Manila. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from the Philippine capital.
The 42-year-old American was hiking with a German companion on the slopes of Mount Pinatubo on Wednesday when they were attacked by armed gunmen. He was killed, but the 52-year-old German was only wounded and managed to alert authorities of the attack through a text message from his cellular phone. An army spokesman said today that the American's body was found near the crater of the volcano. The ambush occurred as Philippine and U.S. troops started training exercises to fight Muslim militants in the south of the country. A police spokesman said the killing had nothing to do with the stationing of U.S. troops, but so far the motive is unclear. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Manila.
Zimbabwe's parliament has passed a controversial media bill that critics say is designed to stifle opposition to President Robert Mugabe. The bill sets up a commission that would license journalists. It would impose strict controls on local media with penalties ranging up to 2 years in prison. It would also limit the rights of foreign reporters. The European Union has threatened to impose sanctions on Zimbabwe if the government interferes with news coverage of the presidential election scheduled for March. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've learned the hard way about the Al-Qaeda network. Today we're going to talk about extremist Islamic groups in Central Asia, the place that my guest Ahmed Rashid says is almost certain to become the next global battleground. This is the area that comprises the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Rashid is the author of the new book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. His previous book, Taliban, was first published by Yale University Press in the year 2000. After September 11th, it became a number one bestseller. Rashid is a Pakistani journalist who covers Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph in England. In your book, you say that Central Asia is almost certain to become the next global battleground. Why do you think that's true?
Well, there are very serious problems in Central Asia. The first is that, you know, 10 years after the breakup of the Soviet Union and the independence of these five states, the economic livelihood of the 90% of the population has gone down dramatically. There's been very little investment. There's been no economic reform. People are very angry and very upset and really not being able to make a living. The other problem is the lack of political reforms being carried out by the governments, the five governments of the region. There's a lot of political frustration. Something like 60% of the population in Central Asia, that's about 50 million people, 60% of them are now under 25 years old. They don't remember the Soviet era. They don't remember the kind of, how everything, you know, despite the fact that it was a Soviet system, but everything at least functioned. There was a health system, an education system. They're only seeing a kind of chaotic breakdown. And to top it all, there is the introduction of radical Islam. And a lot of young men are becoming radicalized. They go, because there's no overt political activity, they go underground. They join these radical organizations which are seeking the overthrow of these regimes. So there are an enormous number of problems.
How connected are the radical Islamic groups of Central Asia to the terrorist network that has attacked the United States? In other words, I'm asking the question a lot of people will be wondering, which is how much of the radical Islamic movements of Central Asia are our direct problem?
Well, one of the most militant groups, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which is seeking the overthrow of not just the Uzbek regime, but the regimes in Kyrgyzstan also, and Tajikistan, had bases in northern Afghanistan. They were funded by Osama bin Laden. They had something like 3,000 fighters who were fighting for the Taliban and for Al-Qaeda. And they were very heavily bombed by the Americans. They were defending the Taliban positions in November last year, Several hundred were killed. Several hundred were captured and killed in that massacre, if you remember, of the prisoners in Mazar-e-Sharif. And there have been reports that one of the main military commanders of the Islamic movement, Juma Namangani, was actually killed in the bombing, although it's still not clear. Nobody has seen the dead body. Nobody has got a confirmation. But there, you know, several people have said that he was killed. So they did have links. I mean, and clearly the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan has disrupted the IMU quite seriously. But, of course, it has not really affected their cells and their activities inside Central Asia itself.
Now, in your book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, you write about three main militant Islamic groups in Central Asia. And you say that although they began with different ideologies and agendas and support bases, the situation in Central Asia is pulling them together. What are the things they have in common now in terms of their agendas?
Well, I think what they have in common, basically, is opposition to all the regimes in Central Asia. And they've really lost hope that any of these Central Asian regimes are going to modify their position, carry out economic or political reforms, or start a dialogue with them. I think the other thing that is linking them is that they all have a political tendency to see Central Asia as one unit. That is, they would like to see an Islamic Central Asia under one government. Now, that is, you know, they don't see these borders. They see these borders of the five states as being artificial, having been created by the Soviet Union and the communist system. They see themselves as kind of liberating the whole region. And one of them, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, even includes parts of Muslim China, that is the Chinese province of Xinjiang, as being part of what they call Turkestan, that is the ancient word for Central Asia, the ancient Muslim Turkic word for Central Asia. They would like to see the Islamic Republic of Turkestan stretching, you know, from the Black Sea, you know, across Central Asia into China.
Well, you say they don't really believe in the borders of these different republics and that, you know, these borders were created by the Soviets. And you point out in your book that Stalin created some of these borders with the intent of what?
Well, after the Russian Revolution in 1917, there was a very bloody civil war between the communists, the Reds, and the Whites. That is the you know, those elements loyal to the former Tsar. And much of that civil war was actually fought in Central Asia, because at the same time there was Muslim resistance to the communists. You know, the people in Uzbekistan, Tajiks, Uzbeks, the Turkic people of Central Asia resisted the communist takeover. And that civil war actually went on for about 10 years till about 1927. But once it was over and the communists won and Stalin was in power, he wanted to fragment this region as much as possible, simply because he didn't want them to come together in any shape or form. And you get the creation of five republics, of very artificial borders, which split ethnic groups, which divided tribes, which even divided villages and towns in a very random way, in a sense, but in a very methodical way, to make sure that these five republics, the peoples of these five republics, would never be able to come together again.
So really, these five states in Central Asia don't represent organic boundaries. The boundaries were created by Stalin to keep the area fragmented.
No, not at all. I mean, if you take, for example, the Fergana Valley, which is the sort of always been the political and Islamic center of Central Asia, where about 10 million people live. That's about one-fifth of the population of the whole of Central Asia lives in the Fergana Valley. The Fergana Valley, it's a very narrow valley, about 100 miles long and about 100 miles across. It's been divided between three countries. Stalin divided it between Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, split the valley. So you've got borders, you know, crisscrossing the valley, making any kind of normal agricultural activity, irrigation, water supply, electricity grid, you know, making anything like that you know, very difficult and very impractical and very debilitating for the population.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of the number one bestseller, Taliban. He's the author of a new book called Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He's a Pakistani journalist who's the Central Asia correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph in England. Now, the Soviet Union suppressed religions. No matter what the religion was, they suppressed it, and that includes Islam. So in Central Asia, Islam was suppressed during the Soviet era, but it's still suppressed under the rulers of the five republics of Central Asia. Why do they continue to suppress Islam?
Well, they see Islam, Islamic radicalism, as a threat. Now, the point is that all the rulers of the five republics in Central Asia are leftovers from the communist era. There has been no political change of leadership in Central Asia during the last 10 years, which is quite amazing. For example, if you look what's happened in Russia with Gorbachev, Yeltsin, Putin, I mean, there have been very, you know, there have been serious political changes. In Central Asia, all these leaders were former general secretaries of their local communist parties. They became president. They said that they would now sort of usher in democracy. But, you know, for the last 10 years, they've had elections, but nobody's allowed to stand in those elections against them. They win these elections by like 99% of the vote, very reminiscent of the Soviet era. And I think, you know, what people have been wanting is that, yes, take a position or take a political stance against radicalism and violence and, you know, the violent overthrow. But, you know, be sympathetic to cultural expressions of Islam, natural expressions of Islam. Islam is part of Central Asian history, part of the culture, part of the tradition. You know, don't act like a Soviet bureaucrat. But unfortunately, what we've seen in the mid-90s has been a very kind of classic Soviet-style crackdown on all expressions of Islam. So, for example, in Uzbekistan, if a villager was going to the mosque five times a day, which is a normal Muslim practice, the police would come in and question him and saying, you know, why aren't you going just once a day? Why are you going five times a day? And people were hauled in for questioning for very normal practice of Islam.
My guest is Ahmed Rashid, author of the new book Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He wrote the bestseller Taliban. His new book, Jihad, is about the rise of militant Islam in Central Asia. Let's look at the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. This was formed in 1998. What are the goals of this group?
Well, initially their goals were to setting up an Islamic Republic in Uzbekistan and toppling the regime of President Islam Karimov. But since then, they seem to be now talking about liberating, as they say, the whole of Central Asia and setting up an Islamic Republic across what they call Turkestan. Certainly, you know, in their recruitment drive, and many of their militants are militants who they've got in Afghanistan, these groups now include all the ethnic groups of Central Asia, that is Tajiks, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, Uzbek, Turkmen, and they also have Chinese Muslims. They have Muslims now from the Caucasus, Chechens, Dagestanis. So it's become a very kind of pan-Islamic group. And the other problem is, of course, that like Al-Qaeda and like the Taliban, they are extremely secretive. They don't give interviews. There are no photographs of their leadership. They don't hold press conferences. They don't issue handouts as to what their aims are. So it's very difficult trying to get a handle on exactly what they want and what they're after. And it needs a lot of patient kind of investigation, you know, as far as somebody like myself is concerned, a journalist, to try and dig out, actually, what are they standing for right now?
Now, the leader of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan is Juma Namangani. There's a lot of secrecy surrounding him, and some people believe he actually died during the war in Afghanistan. What are his greatest accomplishments said to be?
Well, he is the military commander of the IMU, and he started his guerrilla operations in 1999 against Uzbekistan, and basically tried to attack the Fergana Valley, this crucial valley which is split up between three states. And his aim was to first set up a Islamic Republic in the Fergana Valley and then expand and try and set up a kind of liberated area in Fergana. He launched guerrilla attacks repeatedly in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and in Uzbekistan, basically to try and gain access to the Fergana Valley, because the valley is divided by these three countries. He did not succeed, but he created enormous ruckus, because these armies are not very well trained. They've had no experience in fighting a guerrilla war, and there was all this kind of mythology around the power of these guerrilla units of the IMU. And he's been very successful in creating, not so much in being militarily successful by, you know, killing a lot of soldiers or by actually taking towns and villages, but he's been very successful at creating a huge political scare within these governments.
Now, let me move on to another group, which is the Hizb ut-Tahrir. This is the Party of Islamic Liberation, and it's called the HT for short. How does it compare to the IMU?
Well, the HT has a very clear stated goals. This is a pan-Islamic movement that wants to create a Muslim caliphate. The caliphate was the Muslim governance, the style of governance that followed the Prophet Muhammad's death in Arabia. And there were four khalifas following the Prophet's death. And that period of the khalifas is seen as the kind of ideal style of government, in the entire Muslim era. And what HT is trying to do is to recreate that. And what they say is that we want to recreate this right across the Muslim world. That is, include every country in one central Muslim government. And the first step in that is to create a caliphate in the Central Asian region. So they are pan-Islamic. They have very wide links, not so much to bin Laden, but they have very wide links to Islamic groups all over the Muslim world. They have subsidiary HT groups in the Middle East, in North Africa, in South Asia. But their most prominent political success has actually come in Central Asia. They came very late to Central Asia. They only arrived in Central Asia in about 94, 95. A lot of their leaders are based in Europe. They have enormous access to technology, the internet, email. They have a lot of money, it seems, from donations. And they've been able to spread their message, not so much through fighting, but rather through email, the internet, and also that they have a very methodical system of setting up secret cells, five-man cells, and each member of this cell is supposed to create another cell. So it's a kind of mushrooming growth of cells. But nobody can really judge how powerful they are because, of course, they're underground. What you can judge is that the authorities in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan have been arresting hundreds of members of HT groups in the last 2 years. And in fact, they've been arresting far more members of HT than they've been arresting of the IMU. And I think, you know, that's a reflection of the kind of growing popularity and the growth of this movement.
Now, HT sounds like, because it has access to the internet and stuff, that it gives out more information than the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan does. But it sounds like HT is still pretty secretive, even though it gives out information.
Yeah, it's very secretive. I mean, the cell system it has set up is very secretive. They're very sensitive about not being penetrated by the intelligence agencies of these countries. But, you know, at the same time, as you say, you know, they do have a much clearer ideology. I mean, they want to set up a caliphate. They also say that they don't believe in violence. They don't believe in guerrilla war. And they expect that one day Muslims, you know, in Central Asia will rise up in their millions and take to the streets and topple these regimes. Now, my sense is, talking to young members of HT, is that a lot of them, in fact, are very much in favor of guerrilla war. And they're very anti-America. They're very anti-Israel. They accuse President Karimov of Uzbekistan as being a stooge of Zionism and as a stooge of Israel. I see many of these young people who are talking in this kind of very militant way as possibly taking to guerrilla war at some stage, and the leadership of HT may not have much control over them. My other major point about HT is that, you know, it's very much an imported ideology. This is not an ideology which is really rooted in the Islamic traditions and culture of Central Asia.
It's not.
No, I mean, you know, the fact is that the leadership of HT lives outside Central Asia. Many of them are Arabs. They're not Central Asians. Much of the kind of propaganda material that is distributed by HT inside Central Asia is talking about issues which have very little relevance to Central Asian people. It's talking about the Palestinian issue. It's talking about, you know, anti-Americanism, anti-Israel. It's not really trying to address the day-to-day problems of food and prices, and, you know, the economic problems and the social and political problems that the people of Central Asia face. And the second issue is that, you know, this is the HT was a party that was set up initially in the 1950s in the Middle East. It comes out of the Wahhabi Islamic traditions of Saudi Arabia and some of the extremist groups from the Palestinian diaspora in the Middle East. It was not set up by Central Asians. And consequently, you know, having this kind of pan-Islamic aim and having this kind of ideology, which is coming from the Middle East, means that they have very little understanding of the traditions of Central Asia. Central Asian Islam has traditionally been very moderate, very tolerant. The Sufi tradition, or the spiritual, mystical tradition in Central Asia, where they believe in dance and music and participation by women, you know, these are the traditions of Central Asia, of Central Asian Islam. And HT is very rigid. It's very anti-Sufi. It's very anti-mysticism. It's very restrictive towards women. And women participating in religious ceremonies. So, you know, all this kind of goes against the traditions of Central Asia. Now, I fully understand it's becoming popular simply because it's seen by many people as the only thing that's going at the moment and which is ready to oppose these regimes. But I think, you know, the Central Asian people are going to find major problems if they adopt the ideology of the HT, because the ideology is not rooted in the traditions that they know about.
Ahmed Rashid is the author of the new book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Audi and the all-new A4. Information is available on the web at audiusa.com or 1-800-4-AUDI. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the Lives of the Disabled, a work of nonfiction by Andrew Potok. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid tells us how he made contact with leaders of underground radical Islamic groups in Central Asia.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of the book Taliban, which became a number one bestseller after September 11th. In his new book, Jihad, he writes about the militant Islamic groups in the former Soviet republics of Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. Rashid covers Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and England's Daily Telegraph. Since these radical Islamic groups in Central Asia are very secretive, what's your approach to learning about them? I mean, how often have you been able to actually meet with leaders of the group?
Well, Terry, it's very difficult to tell you the truth. I mean, you know, since the mid-90s, I've been going to Central Asia since 1988, and I started going there during the Gorbachev era and the communist era. And I've been very interested, first of all, in the fact that the ethnic groups in Central Asia were the big daddies of many of the ethnic groups in Afghanistan, which really, and my first interest was Afghanistan, and that's what took me to Central Asia. I wanted to see where these ethnic groups came from. That is the Uzbeks, the Turkmens, the Kazakhs, the Kyrgyz. And then I've been very interested in Central Asian Islam. And of course, you know, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the key question was, you know, that there was an Islamic revival, and would, in the early 90s, the question was, would this Islamic revival turn to radicalism, or would these regimes take a kind of lenient attitude and foster, you know, local Islamic traditions and culture? And unfortunately, you know, they failed to do it, and you've seen the kind of growth of this Islamic radicalism. And because they're very secretive, it's very difficult. I mean, I've been going back since the mid-90s watching the growth of these movements. I haven't met with the top leadership of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. It's been impossible. I spent many weeks hanging around, sending people, sending friends, sending messages through all sorts of routes, trying to meet with them, but I haven't been able to so far. I met with some of the leaders and members of the Hizb ut-Tahrir, the HT movement, and it's taken days to set up these meetings, and very clandestinely, you know, having to meet with them under the eyes of the authorities, not to get them into trouble, not to get myself into trouble. It's been very difficult, the problem is that, you know, they are not open. They're very suspicious of the media, and they're very suspicious of the Western media. I mean, the fact that, you know, I'm a Muslim perhaps helps to some extent. They feel that, you know, the media is in the pay of the intelligence agencies, and so they're very reluctant to come out into the open.
A Wall Street Journal reporter was recently kidnapped. He was arranging to meet with a leader of a militant group, and they decided he was like working with the CIA or something, and he ended up being kidnapped. Are you afraid of being kidnapped while you're arranging a meeting with a secretive leader of one of the militant Islamic groups in Central Asia?
Well, I mean, frankly, that fear is always there, you know. And the fact that, you know, the IMU is known to be extremely violent, and they have very little regard for life and limb of people, which is why, you know, one has to be very cautious. And I have really tended never to go in for anything unless I know the contact or the liaison very well, and unless, you know, people I know well are guaranteeing that I'm going to come back after this meeting. So that's why it's very difficult. I mean, I would never go in blind because, you know, somebody has knocked on my door in my hotel and said, well, I can take you to so-and-so. I would never accept an offer like that. I wouldn't take that kind of risk, either in Afghanistan or in Central Asia. I would have to know exactly who I was talking to, who my contact was, and to have some trust with him.
Tell us about one of your meetings with a leader of the HT, one of the militant Islamic groups in Central Asia. Tell us about what it was like to get taken to see him and what you got out of it.
Well, you know, it took about 4 or 5 days waiting around for some friends were organizing this. People I knew were organizing this meeting, and I trusted them, and I trusted that they would get the right guy and that they would set it up in a way that, you know, I would be safe. I was in the capital, Tashkent. I was then taken out of the capital for a long drive outside the city, and then taken to a place, you know, where I met this person for about 2.5 hours. And it was very clear. I mean, he had a very detailed kind of information about, you know, how strong they were, how popular they were, where they were operating, what their ideology was, even how popular they were within government circles. And in fact, how they had penetrated the army, the bureaucracy, and even, he claimed, the intelligence services. Now, naturally, there was no way I could kind of confirm any of this. But, you know, it was very clear that, you know, this was a very important leader. And I put a lot of these questions to him. I said, look, you know, I'm a Muslim, and I've read a lot of books and pamphlets published by the HT, which, by the way, are available in English in large quantities in Pakistan and many Muslim countries. I mean, you can buy them for virtually nothing. And many of their works have been translated into English and to many other languages, of course, all the Central Asian languages. So I put to him, I said, look, you know, I feel that this is very much an imported ideology. And, you know, this has nothing to do with the traditions of Central Asia, of the tolerance, of the mysticism, of the Sufism. And I had a, you know, very extended kind of religious dialogue, trying to understand that why are you taking on what I consider to be an imported ideology? I prefer the Islam of what I grew up in, which is, you know, a Pakistani version of a Pakistani interpretation of Islam. And why don't you go back to your own roots, which are so rich in tradition and culture and learning and scholarship, you know?
What did he say?
Well, you know, really, he had been, in my opinion, you know, almost completely brainwashed by HT propaganda that, you know, we want to create this Islamic State right around the world. And everybody else, all these non-Muslim countries, the Western countries, are in fact kafir, that is, you know, unbelievers. But they ultimately, before the Day of Judgment and the end of the world, they will also be converted to Islam. So there was a kind of, you know, very messianic kind of message, and it was almost impossible to have a dialogue. And of course, I have found that also with the Taliban and with Al-Qaeda over the years, that there is now, in this kind of concept of global jihad, and I describe global jihad in my book, in these new groups that have come up over the last 7 or 8 years, there's a kind of messianic form to them, which normal Muslims who are steeped, if you like, I mean, I'm not a scholar of Islam, but I mean, I'm steeped in my traditions and my religion and my culture. It's very difficult for people like me to understand this concept of global jihad and to break through the kind of wall that the proponents of global jihad set up, which is that, don't, yes, you're a Muslim, but, you know, you can't criticize us because you are not a full believer. You know, you don't understand this idea of global jihad, and you are kind of far too intellectual and perhaps far too emotional and far too liberal and far too westernized, which is why you're not accepting our idea of global jihad. So HT are coming from this, you know, very worrisome trend, which is also, of course, reflected in the Taliban and in Al-Qaeda and many groups in Pakistan.
That's a very convenient way of dismissing anything you say, isn't it? Just accusing you of being Western.
Exactly. I mean, you know, not only accusing me of being Western, but accusing my knowledge of Islam as being too liberal and not being motivated enough, you know, and that, in fact, it's anti, this kind of global jihad is actually anti-intellectualism. It's anti-scholarship. It's they're not interested in having a debate about Islamic tradition or Islamic scholarship or the way that I might understand Islam or somebody else might understand Islam. They have a point of view, and anything which kind of criticizes that point of view is anti-Muslim, or as they see it, anti-Muslim. And the second point I make to them, all of them, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and these groups in Central Asia, is, look, what do you want to do for the people? What's your economic agenda? What's your social agenda? Are you going to make, you know, the people literate? Are you going to have a health service for the people? You know, do you want foreign investment? I mean, how are you going to develop the economy? And the problem is that with this concept of global jihad, there is no social agenda. There is no civic agenda. There is no concept of civil society and what we as militants are going to do for civil society. This is the other problem. The HT has an enormous amount of literature now, which you can access on the internet, you can buy their books, and there is nothing there about civil society to what services you will provide.
Well, as you point out in your book, their agenda really seems to be just about regulating personal behavior. In addition to overthrowing the heads of state where they live.
Yeah, to a very large extent it is. And like the Taliban, the Taliban said, we are imposing Sharia, that is Islamic law. And once we impose Sharia, magically, everything will fall into place. The economy, education, health, foreign policy, everything will fall into place. But we have not imposed Sharia yet. But the day that all Afghans become, follow Sharia, everything else will happen automatically because, God will bless us. And that's really the kind of feeling of some, of these other groups. And it's very difficult to argue against this.
My guest is Ahmed Rashid, author of the new book Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He wrote the bestseller Taliban. His new book, Jihad, is about the rise of militant Islam in Central Asia. Are a lot of the leaders of the radical Islamic groups of Central Asia people who were educated at the religious schools in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, such as the places where the Taliban were radicalized?
To some extent, yes. There is a large proportion of them who have been through the madrasas, the religious schools in Pakistan and in Saudi Arabia, but certainly not to the extent of the Taliban. But I must say there's a lot of funding that has gone in from Saudi Arabia in particular, and to some extent from Pakistan and the religious groups in Pakistan. A lot of funding has gone in for these militant groups. The Islamic movement of Uzbekistan has been hugely funded by Saudi groups, Saudi charities, Saudi princes, and the Uzbek diaspora in Saudi Arabia. Apart from bin Laden, I think the main source of funding for the IMU has been Saudi Arabia.
The United States has oil interests in Central Asia. There are American companies that have bases in Central Asia. How do you see oil figuring into the future of Central Asia? For instance, first of all, you say that the oil companies give a lot of money to the rulers of the Central Asia republics.
There are very extensive American investments from the oil companies, oil and gas companies in Central Asia, because Central Asia is seen as the last reservoir, if you like, of unknown and untapped oil reserves in the world. We don't know more than about 10% of the reserves at the moment. 90% of these regions have not even been explored yet. So there is enormous interest. And there's enormous interest for the U.S. to build pipelines out of landlocked Central Asia, which would not go through Russia, not go through Iran, but come through either the southern Muslim countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, or go through Turkey and then come into Europe. So there is an enormous, battle for influence that has been going on over the last 10 years between Russia, the Americans, the Chinese, the Iranians, for access to this oil and the routes along which these pipelines will be built. And certainly now that the U.S. has a military presence in Central Asia, it's set up military bases in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan because of the war against terrorism, this fight for influence and for pipelines and for oil is certainly going to increase.
Now, how do the radical Islamic groups see the Western oil companies that have set up shop in Central Asia?
Well, certainly they see them as a threat and as a target. And I think, you know, if there is going to be a targeted reaction to the American military presence in Central Asia because of the campaign in Afghanistan, then I fear that the oil companies in these capital cities in Central Asia could well be targeted.
Do you think that September 11th, that the attacks against the United States and then the United States attacks against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, do you think they have strengthened or weakened the radical Islamic groups of Central Asia?
Well, militarily speaking, they've weakened them, obviously, because some of them were, you know, some of them have been killed. Their operations has been disrupted. Their financing from abroad has been disrupted, much in the same way that al-Qaeda has been disrupted. I mean, these groups have been disrupted very seriously. But I don't think, you know, they have been totally destroyed. Now, in the long term, I mean, they are going to reorganize. And if the U.S. military presence in Central Asia is going to remain, there is a very strong chance that they're going to reorganize on the basis of anti-Americanism and trying to whip up public feeling that, you know, the Americans are now propping up these our regimes, and that the regimes are evil and the Americans are evil because they're propping them up. So, you know, there's a very strong chance that, you know, anti-Americanism, which is not strong at the moment at all. I mean, there's no real anti-American feeling in Central Asia. This could become a kind of mobilizing factor for these radical groups in the future.
This week in President Bush's State of the Union address, he talked about the axis of evil being Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. I wonder what your reaction is to that statement and to the implication that the United States might be going after terrorists in Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, or going after those governments for harboring terrorists.
Well, I really do believe it's going to be a very big issue. I don't think that going after other countries, after Afghanistan right now, I think the U.S. is going to face major problems. The coalition, the Western coalition, is not going to hold together. The coalition of Muslim countries is not going to hold together. For example, if Somalia or Yemen or Iran even is targeted. Unless there's going to be some kind of resolution or some kind of movement towards a resolution in the Middle East, and the U.S. is at the moment not, you know, the U.S. at the moment is seen by many Muslims around the world, and certainly by the Arab regimes, by the Palestinians, as being hugely biased towards Israel. If there's, you know, going after terrorism is going to also need a simultaneous effort by the U.S., I think, to bring peace to the Middle East and to be appearing to be more even-handed between Israel and the Palestinians.
Now, you recently flew to the United States. You're speaking to us now from New York, and you came here because you have a new book. You also came here to speak at the World Affairs Council, the Council on Foreign Relations, and to meet with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Nevertheless, when you landed in the United States, you were detained at the airport for questioning.
Yeah, this happened last time.
This was a previous trip. Okay,
yeah,
this was a previous trip.
Yeah.
So when was that exactly?
In December.
Yeah. I wonder how you feel about being detained for questioning. Because, like, on the one hand, you understand better than anyone the problem of terrorism. On the other hand, you're no terrorist. You have a pretty high profile, and a lot of us are really relying on you for explanations of what's going on. You're one of the great sources of knowledge and information right now.
God, Terry, I don't know what to say to this. I mean, it was no big deal.
I was wondering if you thought of it as a big deal, if it made you angry, or if you thought, well, it's...
No, it was no big deal. I mean, it was really no big deal. I mean, there wasn't any kind of harassment or anything like that. It just took a lot of time up, that was all. And one understood, I mean, you know, the reasons, you know, for this. And I think, you know, there is a lot of fear here, and it continues to grow that there will be perhaps another terrorist attack on the United States. I can only presume that the fact is that a lot of these cells of al-Qaeda, sleeper cells of al-Qaeda, have not been caught. They may have been disrupted, their finances may have been stopped or whatever, but, you know, a lot of these guys are still around in Western capitals, in Europe, in the States, and even in many Muslim countries. You know, we've just seen what's happened in Malaysia and Singapore, where two major cells of al-Qaeda were discovered and broken up, and people were arrested. So, you know, this is going going to be a long-term threat. And I think there is going to be a kind of revenge attack at some stage on American or European targets for what has happened in Afghanistan. The other thing is that if some of these cells feel that the police are kind of creeping in on them and are about to take them, some of these cell members may well feel, well, we might as well carry out an attack now and be done with it and die rather than be arrested.
My guest is Ahmed Rashid, author of the new book Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid. He is a Pakistani journalist who's the author of the number one bestseller, Taliban. His new book is called Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. And he covers Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph in England. You're from Pakistan. Now, in the United States, your previous book, the Taliban book, was a number one bestseller. Now you have a new book. A lot of us in the media have come to really rely on you for information about a part of the world that's very difficult to get information from. I'm wondering how you're regarded in Pakistan, in your own country, if you're seen as very controversial there. I imagine Pakistan is very divided now. About extremist Islam. So are you a controversial figure in your own country?
Yes, I am. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The fact is that I was very critical of Pakistan's support to the Taliban before September the 11th. That didn't endear me to the military regime there, the intelligence services, the foreign ministry. And even after September 11th, when Pakistan dropped support of the Taliban and joined the American alliance, I was not, and even though now the regime and my point of view, if you like, we're all on the same side, they haven't really liked me at all or kind of reached out to me in any way. And of course, a lot of the fundamentalist groups are see me as very controversial. They see the book as being a very anti-Islam, anti-Taliban. There have been, reviews of the book which have condemned me as being, a stooge for the West, an agent of, this country or that country. But then there has been an incredible amount of support from people. And many Pakistanis are very grateful for the book that, it kind of warned them, what many people have told me, that it was very prophetic, that it warned Pakistan, the government, the people of Pakistan, well before September 11th, that, supporting the Taliban was a disastrous policy.
Are you very worried about the future of your country? And I'm thinking for a couple of reasons. One is the threat of Islamic extremism, and the other is the possibility of war with India over Kashmir.
Well, this period since September the 11th has been very traumatic for Pakistan. I mean, you've seen, President Musharraf had to do this U-turn after September 11th, that is, dropping the Taliban and supporting the Americans to actually defeat and crush the Taliban. And then India then took advantage, mobilized its troops, and now Musharraf has had to do another U-turn, which is basically to crack down on these Islamic groups, militant groups inside Pakistan and some of the Kashmiri groups. And This is also very controversial, but I think, you know, by and large, the general public in Pakistan were fed up with these Islamic groups because they were kind of holding the whole of society and the economic and political future of the country hostage. They were preventing foreign investment. They were preventing normal education. They were preventing people leading normal lives. And generally, it's been very welcomed, I think, at the steps that the regime have taken. The dangers of rollback are still very strong, because at some stage, obviously at the moment, the American military campaign in Afghanistan continues. At the moment, the fundamentalist groups are not rearing their heads. But at some stage of the game, they're going to react. And it's not certain yet how they could react very violently against both Musharraf, against the regime, against intellectuals. We don't know how they're going to react. So the situation is still quite tense.
I wonder if you're taking Islamic militancy especially personally, because one of the things it's attacking is your own interpretation of Islam.
Yes, I mean, I'm interested in this intellectually and politically speaking. You know, as a political expression, militant Islam as a political expression interests me enormously. Certainly, they can see my writings as being, not supporting their point of view. But I think, you know, the Muslim world needs more people to be standing up and saying that what these radical groups represent is not Islam. And it's certainly not the indigenous Islam that has developed in a particular country, whether it's Central Asia or Pakistan.
Well, Ahmad Rashid, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ahmad Rashid is the author of the new book, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He's also the author of the bestseller, Taliban. He covers Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph. We'll close with music by the late Pakistani singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Comedy Central begins a 5-part look at the heroes of black comedy next week. On the next Fresh Air, we go into our archives for interviews with Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, Bill Cosby, Bernie Mac, Damon Wayans, and others. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.